Thank you, Maggie. So this is a thrill for me to have Paula, a thrill for me to meet Paula. I was with Walter Brueggemann at a conference on neighborhood economics a little over a year ago. And Paula was there, and then we met, and now we're kind of in this conversation of how do we, what's the possibilities for poor neighborhoods, marginal neighborhoods, economy that works for all. And I know she's very interested in that. But Paul, how about just thank you for being on. And, you know, John asked you a question a minute ago, how do you combine your interest in neighborhoods and economic development? And then you're a lawyer. Could you tell a little bit about the transition from you being a private sector lawyer into the public arena and where you are now?
And people might not know what a solicitor is, so why don't you start there?
Okay, that I can do all of that. So the city solicitor of the city of Cincinnati heads the law department, so basically the chief legal officer of the city, providing legal representation to all of the departments and boards and commissions and city officials of the city. I was with a city... in fact, when I was a young lawyer, I was a litigator, and I began to work on neighborhood issues, so really issues of quality of life and blight and nuisance abatement work. So really working closely with community development corporations and community councils to identify and address their concerns in their neighborhoods. And that work... led me to leave the city and go to work for the Port Authority, where I did community development work for my full-time job. And that is how I became interested in neighborhood economics and place-based economies. And so when the mayor and city manager asked me to come back to the city to be the solicitor, I told them I was bringing these wonderful things with me, and they thought that was just fine. So that is why I'm still involved in these issues, because I think, you know, it's they're issues that the city cares about very much, particularly this administration under this leadership. So yeah, I think it's everyone wins all the way around.
Thank you, Paula. How would you define the issues confronting our neighborhoods? What aspect of neighborhood economics, neighborhood life resonates with you, touches you, makes you so passionate about it? What is it that you're trying to do something about before we get to what you're going to do about it?
Well, I think that we can't separate out distinct issues within a neighborhood. We have to understand that everything is connected. So the safety is connected to, economy within the neighborhood and development within the neighborhood. And I think what makes me excited is that, the idea of harnessing the energies of the people who live in under-resourced neighborhoods and allowing them to create their own opportunities, just giving them the skills and empowerment to do that. That, I think, is the most exciting thing, because I think for too long we've looked at neighborhood problems as, we have to go in and help these poor neighborhoods, when really we just have to provide them with the same opportunities and education that other communities have that aren't under-resourced.
Why does that matter, Paula? What in you resonates so much to the people on the margin?
Well, I think that I think I have a strong sense of justice. And I think that...
Really?
It's, yes, I know. That is... that's strange.
No
lawyer, right?
No.
But, you know, I think that ultimately the idea that we can't really prosper as a community or as a society if we're not working to ensure equal opportunities for everyone. It really, that's something that I feel very passionate about. I think that's should be a guiding philosophy for us as we move forward.
That's wonderful. Why has it been so hard? You know, John and I and you, less years, and many others have worked so hard to build the capacity, gifts, economic. Why has it been so difficult? What's the obstacle? What's before we talk about what we can do about it, what's your stance from your perspective as to why it's been so difficult? Like every city now still has neighborhoods that are, you know, marginalized and under-resourced.
Well, I think there are a couple of problems, right? So first is that many decisions are made without considering the community or the neighborhood context. So a lot of the decisions in Cincinnati in particular around just the interstate highway systems that divided neighborhoods and kind of destroyed business districts and really removed the center of life in a lot of neighborhoods. So those are kind of, you know, historical problems, but obviously the effects are still very much felt today. And I think the continuing problem is one of a failure to recognize the gifts and the power within the community itself to harness the power of what's happening within that neighborhood. You know, I think that is something that we continue to struggle with. And I think now there is this, you know, national movement towards recognizing that, honoring it, you know, empowering it. But, I mean, we still have a lot of work to do in that regard.
I thought that's a beautiful way of saying it that I hadn't thought of before. That when we, some of the ways, the way we so-called develop neighborhoods, an interstate system or an access, what we do is we scrape and rebuild. And you say when you do that, you remove the center of life. When you take out a business district, it's not just the commerce, because people can shop somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But you remove the center of life. So what we're doing, and what you're doing, is saying how do we restore the center of life for neighborhoods that we've kind of colonized or not, you know, that's a beautiful thing.
Paula, you've mentioned at least three positions that you've held, and you come with this amazing recognition that local people have abilities, talents, and gifts. Have you been able to influence the people who've worked for or with you around that proposition rather than these are broken neighborhoods and broken people and we have the responsibility to fix them?
You know, absolutely. I think that at least here in the city, both from the mayor's office and within the administration led by the city manager, you know, there is increasing awareness of ensuring that neighborhoods have a voice in their own, we'll call it redevelopment or, you know, whatever we want to term that. I think that, you know, this idea of the micro business gap and place-based economies are also things that resonate very much with the people in this government. I think, you know, looking for ways to ensure that that we are capturing what really is a great entrepreneurial movement in, you know, across the country, but in particular, you know, ensuring that neighborhoods are part of that and that the people who live in neighborhoods are part of that. Yes, we have worked with Xavier University, you know, to work on this this micro enterprise incubator in neighborhoods for place-based businesses, and we are, you know, we've worked on a lot of those kinds of things that honestly are all in the preliminary stages. But I'm very, very happy that we have city officials with whom those ideas really resonate.
We're just, they're in the conversation at a minimum. And, you know, you said it's really more than development. Sometimes the highway system and the scraping and building is in the name of development. And you really, and it's more than asking neighbors to be getting input from them. It's really giving them the productive capacity to control their economic lives. And it's good. And that's what the micro business to me is a metaphor for. No matter how small your business is, it's essential to this task of renewing the center of life in a neighborhood. So what you say makes great sense. You have a solution in mind, don't you? Or how do you think about what would make a difference in addition to the city caring about it? What comes to mind when you think of what we can do to revitalize the center of life in these neighborhoods?
Well, so I think there are a lot of really good things happening across the city and, you know, really in the region. But one thing that does seem to be missing is I think there's a lot of different silos of great work. And I think that if it were more of an ecosystem, if things, if people and projects were more connected to one another, I think we could really start to build momentum within the movement toward creating, growing more place-based businesses and providing access to capital for those micro-businesses. So I think one is the Neighborhood Economics Conference that's coming to Cincinnati in November is really an opportunity for us to do just that, for us to connect all of these people doing this great work and, you know, really provide opportunities for them to support the work that the other is doing. But then, you know, I also think that making a really focused effort to build a fund that will provide access to meaningful capital for micro-businesses, you know, businesses whose ask will be less than $50,000, you know. I think that's the kind of thing that will be transformational within this whole movement.
Well, can you describe what you have or have in mind in terms of the development of such a fund? Where will that capital come from? And the second question, I suppose, is how do you work in neighborhoods so that the local enterprises know that that's available? How do you make the connection between the capital and the local groups, local businesses?
So I think a couple of things on the way that a fund like that would look. I think it has to be a loan fund that is seeded with money from across sectors, so from government, from philanthropy, from you know, private sector, whether it's individuals or businesses. And so I think that's how the fund has to be structured. It's cross-sector, and it has to be you know, managed with an understanding that there will be some loss, right? There will be loss in the beginning, because what we're really talking about is providing capital and credit to people who are possibly unbankable, right? And however however you want to characterize that, people that don't currently have access to traditional credit. So, you know, I think there's, I think the Neighborhood Economics Conference is another opportunity for us to reach out to would-be donors. I think the other thing that is critically important there is to be able to demonstrate to donors that there really are, that there really is a network of micro businesses that need access to this kind of capital.
Uh-huh.
And so one way to do that is to I think one, connect the accelerators and incubators that are doing neighborhood work right now. You know, there are several across the city that right. are doing really good things, but you know, I'm not sure that the general public is aware of their efforts and their work. I think too, it's important to educate the public and the would-be donors on the microbusiness gap and how what we're really missing in under-resourced neighborhoods are microbusinesses. That is the difference, the main difference between extremely thriving neighborhoods and successful economies and under-resourced neighborhoods and depressed economies is the absence of microbusinesses. It's like a 20% difference, which is pretty incredible, considering that across the you know, mid-size businesses and large businesses, the difference is basically zero.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of it is education, and part of it is saying, look, we do have a crop of people out here that need access to this capital. You know, I honestly don't think it's that hard of a sell. Once we can once we can do those two things, I expect the money to just start flowing in, right, Peter?
Well, yes, and part of why you're important is that your interest, you know, it's a matter of making it credible and giving it credit, legitimacy, efficacy. You know, I think we will do that. And I, you know, another great source of capital is churches. The churches have great endowments, and they don't know what to do with it except to take 5% of their endowment and use it to services to kind of heal the wounds, you know, feed people, house people. And I think if they saw that there was a way to invest in this fund that you've named, where they can get the money back and they can earn some money on it. I think there will be I think if we get the idea right, there's all kinds of money waiting to be useful. Now, you talked about people who are not bankable, but we've been talking about friends and family, that most people who start a business have money from friends and family. And we're looking at people that are uncredentialed, don't have the collateral. And I think we've talked about a friends and family microenterprise loan. So, you say something about why that name makes sense. And
I think, as we've discussed, the lack of opportunity in many ways in under-resourced communities has to do with the either the absence of friends and family who can help in that regard,
right.
And so I think that it's you know, what we have to do, I think, is create a network of friends and family for these people. That I think, you know, that makes me want to wake up in the morning to say, you know, this is something that we can actually do that really will help people, and that does provide an opportunity commensurate with what people in, you know, neighborhoods of means have mm-hmm. access to, just, you know, by birthright, really.
Wow, that's true.
I remember a study, it's a little maybe old now, but it was a study of predictors of success rates in small businesses. And the most significant predictor was the amount of unpaid labor in the business, which meant it was family members doing the work together, as against taking a part of the potential income of the business and paying it out for salaries or for hourly pay. So a great predictor is making accessible to family-oriented businesses capital, because they're more likely to make it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great point. I love that.
I think so. We could ask people, you know, at some point, people need to be qualified. Because, you know, you want to invest in people and build the friends and family around them, but then you got to have some sense of what makes the entrepreneur legitimate. Maybe one measures how many friends and family will help you start for the first year.
Good
thought. Unpaid labor. How much unpaid labor do you have access to? Great, great thought. Now, one other thought, then we'll take questions a little bit. There are some questions in the chat thing. But, you know, it occurred to me, I don't know how much we've talked about it, Paula, but that when people create associations to build support and advocate, it helps. And so we've been thinking about a microenterprise trade association. So there would be actually a structure there where friends, family, caring citizens, which there are a lot of, would kind of join, and then we say, is that still making sense to you, Paula?
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea, Peter. You know, one of the things that, you know, if you read about business success and failures, one of the things that is critically important inside of being a successful entrepreneur is to have a support network and system where you can share your experiences and learn from other people's experiences, you know, failures and successes. And I think a trade association makes so much sense because it offers just that kind of network of support that these businesses will need.
And it also can build a social capital where people start to care for each other.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, there are, if you don't have another question, John, there's some comments on the chat.
Okay, let me ask one more before we get on. I noticed in your bio that you've done some work with land banking in city neighborhoods. And I wonder if you could say some words about that and what its consequence is and why you got into it.
I'd be happy to. You know, the land bank legislation in the state of Ohio was enacted some years ago in 2008 for just one county in Ohio. And as we watched what that county was able to do using this land bank legislation, a statewide coalition formed to expand the legislation to include other counties. And so we worked on that legislation. I was at the city at the time. And then when Hamilton County finally incorporated its own land bank, I went to the Port Authority. And so in the context of my community revitalization work, I also managed the land bank. And in Ohio in particular, the land bank is an incredibly useful tool for acquiring abandoned, vacant properties and repurposing those properties. So it addresses a lot of concerns that neighborhoods have around blight and the condition of vacant properties. So, you know, acquiring property and then being able to either redevelop it as the land bank / Port Authority, or to provide that same property to a person who wants to rehab it or redevelop it for themselves to live in, or in, I'll tell you where the connection between the land bank and neighborhood economics really started to crystallize for me was, there are a lot of vacant commercial properties. And, you know, I was thinking, if we're going to do redevelopment work, if we really are going to focus on, you know, revitalizing some of these abandoned vacant structures, then we can't forget that we have to give people a place to work, right? So the abandoned commercial spaces within a business district seem like a perfect match when you're trying to inspire place-based businesses and economies. So, you know, I think that land bank continues to provide those opportunities. You know, we would love to fill up the business district in Evanston with local entrepreneurs.
Right, so it becomes like a hub, an entrepreneurial hub or a business accelerator, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Would the land, does the land bank maintain ownership of the property and then people develop everything on it, knowing what's on it?
I think there are a number of ways that that those type of development agreements can be structured. I think for entrepreneurs in particular, it seems like being able to rent space so that you're not kind of saddled with the expenses of a whole building, that probably makes sense. So I think, you know, having some sort of build out, so you just, all you have to do is walk into a space and, you know, build it out yourself and then lease that space while the land bank retains ownership. That seems like the best situation for an entrepreneur, but, you know, it doesn't have to be that way.
Got it. That's great. So I'm wondering, Maggie, if you want to open it up to people who want to call in. There are some comments on the chat about how important the neighborhood grocery store is. I know in Clifton, where I live, we lost our grocery store about 4 years ago. And so there's a movement to create a cooperative grocery store, consumer co-op. And the city decided not to fund it at this point, but most of the money has been raised, so I'm sure that will happen. Maggie, you want to open it up to callers, see if anybody wants to call in?
Sure. If you've called in using the telephone, you can hit *8, and I will notice that you've called in and include you into the conversation. And as Peter mentioned, there are some comments in the chat, and that's another way to join the conversation is to type a comment or a question into the chat.
You know, while we're waiting, Paula, it says, can you please share with us how did you start the conversation and build the nucleus of core people? You know, what's your thinking about getting momentum and a kind of tipping point and where what you're talking about becomes, it says here, cool and central. Any thoughts about the movement building part of and your what role you play in that?
Sure. So you know, there is this, I think, honestly, there's a network of women community development professionals that I like to tap into regularly because I don't know if you've noticed, but I think women get a lot of things done. So the first time I start with those ladies.
Under the radar.
Good point. I hadn't noticed.
So I would start with those ladies. So, you know, I'm talking about, you know, the director of LISC, the Development Fund, you know, former mayor Roxanne Qualls, Laura Brunner, of course, at the Port Authority, Jill Meyer at the Chamber. I think all of these groups have a stake in neighborhood success and want to do what they can to, number one, make sure that we're all kind of rowing in the same direction. Two, to make sure that we have to make sure that we have, kind of educated all the people kind of above and beside us to let them know the importance of this movement in particular.
I think that's a great insight because the women, most of development money is about scale. And so most of the regular business incubators, like the one at the chamber, say, well, we're interested in taking you to scale. And so if you're not a certain size, it's not within their mission. The mission is to grow large, large, large. Where I think the feminine side understands that growing small and growing strong is equally important. And this is really, it is not about scale. It's about the presence and productivity of local smaller enterprises in special areas. And so I think when you set up a network of women, kind of philosophically, it makes sense. Because these are the places that in the rush for scale, they don't get the investment dollars. And so you're shifting that. Very, very thoughtful. Thank you.
Well, I wonder about another thing. We've been talking about capital for local small enterprises and the growth of business and economic activity in a neighborhood. What about startups? What about the question of getting more entrepreneurs identified and mobilized and starting businesses in addition to supporting those that are already there? Do you have thoughts on that?
I do. So one of the things that I was very, very keyed up about when I got back from the Neighborhood Economics Conference last year and the SOCAP conference also, was this program that Emory University has been doing called Start Me. And that program they took graduate students, they went to a neighborhood partnered with a CDFI for capital purposes, and then partnered with a community-based organization. And their effort, the whole program, is creating a place-based microbusiness enterprise incubator. And so what they really do is they take ideas, right, and they incubate those into businesses. And so, I went to Atlanta with some folks from Xavier who are led by Roxanne Qualls, our former mayor, she's very excited about bringing this program to Xavier. And so when we were there, they told us that they, literally went door to door and put posters up on, in rec centers and in churches and put notes in, school in backpacks to be taken home from school to just, that just said, do you have a business idea? Are you really good at something? And are you interested in starting or creating a business or learning about that? That program has created many, many, many successful businesses over the last 5 years, and many of which are still in existence in the Clarkston area where the first program took hold. So I think that's one way, right, is to have that kind of program that does that proactive engagement and goes into neighborhoods to really seek out people for startups.
If people wanted to follow up on that, you said it's cited at Emory. Tell us again the name of the initiative.
So it's Emory University. It's called Start Me.
Start Me.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Great.
Let me pause.
We have a caller. Can I invite them into the conversation?
Please.
Hello, I have someone from California. Hello, are you there? Guess not. So we do have another question in the chat. if I can relay that one.
Sure.
Says, how do you get around the traditional time value of money based outlook to such development work?
I don't think you can have that outlook when you're talking about redevelopment. It takes, you know, years and years and years to address kind of all of these issues, right? So vacancy rates, for example, not just rental, but also, you know, actual vacant abandoned property. I mean, it takes years to reset on housing stock and property conditions, and then also to create an economy inside a neighborhood also takes many, many years. So I think that at least people in government are really comfortable with the idea that that takes a long time, you know, and you can't expect overnight wins. So perhaps the resetting of that outlook has to happen inside of the philanthropic community and private businesses. And I think, you know, we have a great example here in Cincinnati of, you know, the amount of time it takes to go from, vastly under-resourced to, approaching safety and redevelopment and all of that. I think that the story of Over the Rhine is one of those. Certainly the missing thing there has been kind of creating a creating something for residents to be able to tap into, to see the benefit of a lot of the new economy in Over the Rhine. But I think just the way, you know, the decade it has taken us to get to where we are now is a pretty good example. And I think most people would view it as a success in terms of safety and redevelopment.
Yeah, I also think what we're asking for is funding that otherwise would be given away. You know, I really think philanthropy is a source of funding for what you're talking about, Paula. And at least here, it's slow money, but there is a return. I know some churches are saying, well, we have these endowments, and in the endowment world or the community fund world, you know, you take 5%, you have to spend it every year. That's by law. And so you say, well, our goal is to maintain the capital, maintain the fund. Where the shift in thinking would be, say, well, we've got, you know, even a small, because I know a small church has got $4 million. Well, the shift in thinking is, why don't we use that $4 million to invest in this kind of enterprise or neighborhood development? And some of that will come back. Now, if the portion that doesn't come back, we'll take it as a loss or as a volunteer investment. You know, because right now the churches give money, they don't get that money back. So there is a replenishment dimension to this, that it might be a very attractive alternative to current to this philanthropic money. And I think that's a real possibility. And the difference is that we want neighborhoods that have a mixture of local businesses and then other more traditional, you know, businesses that come in. And the problem with Over the Rhine, it's all, you know, established or, you know, people with friends, family, collateral, and credentials are running, have the stores now, which is a good thing. But I think... That you go. John, you okay?
Yep. Marsha.
Anyway, so I think getting the money, But I, what?
Yeah. Peter, one thought about churches and local investment is if several churches in a neighborhood came together and set up an investment pool, they could also bring purchasing power to play as well, so that they would become part of the market for the enterprises that they are investing in. Because that's one other thing that's very important in a neighborhood is who's going to buy. And having an investment in local enterprises gives an incentive to support them. So that's a dual purpose, I think, that a church or church federation could have.
Or neighborhood one. I think that's a great point. So the money keeps circulating locally.
Right.
Somebody has the question here, do members of the investment fund share losses and interest revenue? Do members direct their dollars towards specific projects and retain risks yet? These are the kind of questions we're waiting for, because they assume that there is people and money ready to invest in local, you know, place-based things. Any thoughts you have, Paula?
Well, you know, I think, so just a couple of things, and this, so one, I think that, yeah, investors, I think we would want this to be set up as a true investment fund, and so investors would share risk and but also reward kind of at the rate of investment. You know, I think though that the reality, if we really are looking at the kinds of businesses that we're talking about are micro businesses that, you know, will often fail. I think we have to be realistic that what we're going to see in many cases is a loss, right? So the question really is, how much loss can you bear? And this is where I think it's helpful, as you suggested, Peter, to think about this this money as an investment, but also kind of this like mix of philanthropy and investment. Right. Mm. So you're not giving away all that money. You can invest it in this pool. And so you have to just decide how much loss can you bear, because that's the philanthropy part of it, I think.
Beautiful. And again, Maggie, if someone comes on with a question, interrupt us, okay?
Okay. I'd like to do that now then. We have another caller I'll invite in. Hello, this is, are you on the line from South Ohio?
I am.
Great.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello, we can hear you.
This is Gary Robbins here, right here in Cincinnati. So I'm a longtime resident of one of our neighborhoods here. First thing I wanted to say is that I value the locally owned businesses for their willingness to be involved locally versus the franchise or the national company that has the decision makers outside the neighborhood. So it's pretty noticeable over time as to who provides neighborhood support. But a question that I had for Paula here has to do with information about those funding programs. What is an information source that could be made available to residents in a neighborhood? We have the ability to communicate through our council and our newsletters on such things, but I'm hearing about programs today, but I don't know if I have something to distribute.
So at the moment, the Friends and Family Fund is really a dream that Peter and I have. It's not an actual fund yet, although we do have some similar ideas around how to, number one, put it in place so that people who are interested can actually begin to donate. And two, I think that, you know, I certainly expect to know more by the time we get to the Neighborhood Economics Conference in November. So perhaps, you know, I'm sure that that Peter's newsletter will keep folks informed if there are additional developments in this regard. So those are the two sources I think I would suggest for future developments.
Okay. I had one last comment or question here. The Neighborhood Summit that takes place annually over at Xavier is a wonderful opportunity to reach a lot of folks who are active in their neighborhoods. It's part of the planning committee again this year. The theme that's emerging is placemaking. And the topic that you're talking about there, I'm thinking might be a great topic for a built-in workshop at that summit to attract people to show up and learn more about this topic.
So that's usually in March, right? Isn't the neighborhood stuff usually in
the
March?
The date has been set, but I don't recall it. Yes, it's early March.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be, you know, that seems to make a lot of sense. I'm sure people have a lot of ideas or questions around how to either participate in a fund or take advantage of a fund like this. So certainly that seems to make sense.
I look forward to seeing you there.
That leads me to a question that's been on my mind for a while. You know, John, Parker, how do we make this into a movement? What will launch this? What would get this on the radar and make it a big story? Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think, number one is forming a coalition, perhaps is the right word, of organizations that are interested in participating in the creation and administration of a fund that we're talking about. And so then two, I think would be, you know, just good old-fashioned marketing a story to a reporter. And maybe that's really what it takes.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anybody in city government that could do that? This call can be over in a few minutes, you know.
Yeah, I'm ready to pull out all the stops when we're ready to do it.
Here. You're amazing. Maggie, let me ask again, any callers?
No callers at the moment, Peter.
Okay. Any thoughts, John? I just think, you know, you are a bridge, Paula. You work for the city. You say to the people leading the city, this aligns with their interests, having this kind of development. So I think that's very hopeful for me and for all of us. That's why you're so amazing. And you also have the will and the compassion to say, well, I have a job to do, which is represent the legal interests of the city. But the fact that's my job doesn't limit me. I'm also using your platform for something in the common good that you care about. I think that makes you very special. I really appreciate that. John, you have any thoughts?
I vote for you giving the keynote address at the next Ohio Association of Solicitors meeting, which you help all of them see a much broader possibility in terms of their leadership and function than they may at the present time.
Oh, you all are too kind.
All right.
It's been a pleasure talking with both of you. That's for sure. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Paula. This is great. You know, what I like is most of our conversations are about community building, asset-based, people who are doing social inventions. I know you know, what you're really speaking to in a way is peer lending, peer funding. Kiva, I know, is a national movement in that direction. But your willingness to bring money and funding investment right at the center of the neighborhood conversation and the citizen conversation, I think, is really special. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for all of your work, both of you. It's I think these are the kinds of conversations that change the way, you know, government operates and eventually the private sector operates.
All right, Maggie, you want to take us out?
Sure. Thank you, Paula. You give us hope. And we appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. And thank you to our listeners and all of those who were active in the chat, and Gary for calling in. We'll hope you'll join us next time, which we're scheduled for December 8th. And continuing with the neighborhood economics topic, our guest will be Michelle Long, who is director of BALI, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. And the recording from today will be on our website, abundantcommunity.com, so you can hear it again and participate with us through that website. So do stay in touch. And this brings our program to a close today, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.